I hear you calling, Caroline. Behind him, Seabiscuit fidgeted in his stall, fat and impatient, having not felt a saddle on his back for 10 days. It was time to go. Smith went back inside and consulted with Howard. The next night, the trainer loaded the entire Howard barn onto train cars for a trip south to Columbia, South Carolina. There they could train in warm weather and on safe tracks. The choice of South Carolina was a strategic one. Seabiscuit was nominated for the Santa Anita Handicap to be run in March, but Howard had also named him for the Widener Challenge Cup at Florida's Hialeah Racetrack. The races were to be run on the same afternoon. It is highly unlikely that he was considering passing up the 100 grander for the Widener, but he thought the pretense might help in the touchy matter of weights. Santa Anita, undoubtedly because of Seabiscuit, had eliminated the 130-pound weight maximum for the handicap. The weights would be announced that winter, and given the results of the match race, the track racing secretary would obviously be inclined to assign Seabiscuit the biggest impost of his career. So Howard parked his horses between the two tracks and began playing one against the other, hoping to pressure Santa Anita out of giving Seabiscuit an excessive impost. Whenever he could, he made good use of his omnipresent entourage of newsmen. Sitting within earshot of a group of reporters at the Giants' Green Bay football game at the Polo Grounds in New York, Howard wondered aloud which race he would choose. Even in the bucolic surroundings of Columbia, Seabiscuit could not escape the carnival atmosphere. Though the horse was not going to race in the state, carloads of fanatically devoted admirers drove hundreds of miles and swamped the town just to see him gallop in his morning workouts. Each time he cantered around the little training track, a happy whoop went up from his rooting section. Cameramen from the Universal Newsreel Company were crawling all over the town, creating a short subject film of the horse's life. People were flooding the track every time Seabiscuit showed his face. Late in December, Seabiscuit overstepped in a workout and kicked himself in the left foreleg, dinging the suspensory ligament. His leg came up with a little swelling, so Smith backed off on the workouts. Again, Seabiscuit began gaining weight. The reporters came and went. Seabiscuit, bandaged to the elbows, frisked them from over his stall door. Over and over again, Smith was asked why Seabiscuit was bandaged, and over again, he explained that the wraps were merely protective. Just before Christmas, the umpteenth local reporter from the umpteenth little paper eyed the bandages and asked Smith for the umpteenth time what they were for. Smith kept an absolutely straight face. All four of his legs are broken. The shocked reporter rushed to his editors and banged out a story breaking the news. Seabiscuit had fractured all four of his legs, and he would never run again. The ridiculous story might have lived out a brief life in Columbia had the paper not put it out on the national wire, thinking it was the scoop of the season. The next day, papers across the nation were reporting the stunning course of events. Up in Burlingame, California, Howard had just arrived from the east. Seabiscuit had elevated him to superstardom. He was mobbed everywhere he went. While he attended the races at Tanforan with Bing Crosby, the crooner found himself abandoned as fans and autograph seekers smothered Howard. The owner settled back into town to await the 100-grander impost announcement. He killed time by mailing blown-up match race photographs to reporters and taking out ads celebrating the win. On the day Smith made his statement about Seabiscuit's legs, Howard read the story in his evening paper, shrugged it off, and went to bed. He was by now all too familiar with false reports and knew that had anything happened to Seabiscuit, Smith would have been on the phone to him in minutes. But Howard didn't sleep well. Reporters and distraught fans phoned his house all night long. The next morning, when he emerged from the barn, Smith was enveloped by a herd of agitated newsmen. Smith denied again and again that the horse was lame. Some dumb farmer of a reporter saw Seabiscuit with his usual after-exercise bandages on and drew the wrong conclusion, he said. It took 2 weeks for the corrected story to make the rounds. Howard's squeeze play didn't work. The track secretary at Santa Anita loaded Seabiscuit with 134 pounds. Howard swallowed hard. On the day after Christmas, Smith and Howard talked over the phone. The trainer wanted to bring Seabiscuit home from South Carolina without waiting for the Hialeah weights to be announced. Though the injury to the wrapped leg was not serious, the horse was not even lame, he had always worried about that left front suspensory ligament and wanted to be at his home base if trouble developed. They had surely never seriously considered going to Florida anyway. Smith made his case to Howard. Howard wired him back. Come on. Seabiscuit would go in the 100-grander. 134 is a lot of weight, said Howard, but Biscuit is a lot of horse. The next night, the town of Columbia gathered in the darkness to see Seabiscuit off on what would be the final cross-country journey of a career that spanned 50,000 railroad miles. The whistle sounded. The fans shouted their goodbyes, and the train ground forward. For 5 days it pressed westward, parting oceans of fans and newsmen at each stop. Somewhere along the railways, in the heart of the country, Seabiscuit slipped out of 1938. That year, no individual had known fame and popularity that was as intense and far-reaching. At year's end, when the number of newspaper column inches devoted to public figures was tallied up, it was announced that the little horse had drawn more newspaper coverage in 1938 than Roosevelt, who was second, Hitler, third, Mussolini, fourth, or any other newsmaker. His match with War Admiral was almost certainly the single biggest news story of the year and one of the biggest sports moments of the century. The affection that this inarticulate brown horse had aroused, journalist Ed Sullivan would write, was a most amazing thing. Fans scurried all over the unloading platform as Seabiscuit arrived at Santa Anita. The train car door slid open, and the dogs Match, Silver, and Pocatel bounced out, followed by Pumpkin and Seabiscuit. A host of newsreel and newspaper men pushed forward. A line of exercise boys and horsemen stood with them. Smith leaned out the door with the horse, eyeing the crowd with disdain. "We're back for more," he said blandly. Howard dashed forward. "Tom," he practically shouted. "He looks grand, and Happy New Year." He trotted up to greet the horse. "Someone ought to put a shank on Charlie and cool him out," the trainer cracked. "He's more excited than the hoss." Smith and Howard walked off together, radiating pride. Seabiscuit, feeling his oats, bucked a little. They had reason to feel good. Seabiscuit was sound and happy. He had no trace of lameness, and his speed was honed. The only hitch was his weight. He'd been idle in his stall for much of the time since the match, and his weight had crept up. Smith stripped him of his blankets on the morning after his arrival and walked him to the scales. Seabiscuit had gained 30 pounds. So Smith buttoned him into a bright yellow sweating hood and took him to the track at Santa Anita. Since the War Admiral race was over and the weights for the Santa Anita handicap had been announced, the trainer was no longer trying to hide his horse's workouts. Smith's protectiveness had given way to confident magnanimity. "No longer will there be any secrecy to Seabiscuit's moves," he said. "We figure he is the people's horse, and we propose to train him in the open." The people loved the idea. Every time the horse set foot on the course, someone would cry out, "Here comes the Biscuit!" And the track would come to a dead standstill. Each of his workouts was attended by 10,000 or more spectators. They were treated to a show. Smith had never seen the horse so good. His workouts were the fastest of the meeting. He careened around the turns with such reckless speed that Smith began to fear that he would be unable to hold his arc and would tumble over sideways. They took the horse back to the barn and pulled off all of his shoes. While Howard gathered up the old shoes to have them cast into silver ashtrays to give to reporters, Smith got a farrier to design special new turn-gripping shoes. "He's been working so fast," said Smith. "We're afraid he'll run right out of his hide. Already he has to run a bit sideways to keep from flying right in the air." While Seabiscuit steamrolled around the Santa Anita turns, buzzing the infield spectators and scaring the hell out of everyone, Kayak began to come into his own. Smith had known from the beginning that the big black Argentine colt was going to be a 100-grander horse. As he had done with Seabiscuit in 1936, Smith entered the horse in the handicap, but was careful not to show the racing secretary too much, running him just 8 times, always in middling undercard races, 6 of which he won. Kayak improved rapidly. By the time they got to South Carolina, Kayak and Seabiscuit were waging bitter morning workout battles. Seabiscuit was always faster, but no horse, not even Fahrenheitus, had proven so worthy a sparring partner. Smith's plan to keep Kayak's speed a secret worked. The horse drew just 110 for the handicap. With the weights out, Smith had no reason to hide him any longer. Kayak roared into Santa Anita with guns blazing, staging an overpowering performance to win a handicap prep race, just missing a track record, running with ears up, tail fanned out behind him. Coming into the 1939 Santa Anita handicap, Tom Smith was armed to the teeth. It was time to get Seabiscuit into a prep race, but something always intervened. He was scratched out of one race because the field was gigantic, and the post position hung him out so far that he was practically starting the race from the parking lot. He was scratched a second time when the rain turned the track slick. January became February. The handicap was in March, and time was running out. 2 weeks into February, they entered him in the 1 mile Los Angeles handicap. Their luck held. On race day, the sky came up sunny and the field small. Smith spent the day sitting under the slope of the shed row roof. He was accustomed to the giddy ripples of fear that attended race days, but today they had a darker feel. Waves of uneasiness washed over him. Perhaps, he thought, he was giving too much work to an aging animal. The idea tugged at his head all afternoon. By the time he heard the rhythmic, rising chant of Joe Hernandez's voice as he called the undercard races, Smith had begun contemplating scratching the horse once again. Out on the track, the racing secretary was surveying the crowd and worrying. 20,000 fans milled around the grandstand. Another scratch would be a disaster. Climbing up to the boxes, the secretary found Howard and told him that the horse's fans mustn't be disappointed for a third time. A few minutes later, Howard appeared at Barn 38. He and Smith talked about whether or not to run Seabiscuit, and Howard stressed that he didn't want to ruin another day for Santa Anita and the horse's fans. Smith could offer no concrete reason to scratch. He swallowed his trepidation and opted to run. Smith led Seabiscuit to the track. Wolf met him in the paddock, and Smith gave him a leg up. The Iceman leaned down from the saddle and bent his head toward Howard. "We'll set up a track record for you today, Mr. Howard," he said. Wolf broke Seabiscuit smartly, rushing to the lead. On his outside, today, his old rival from 1938 hooked up with him. Down the backstretch, the two horses flew, noses together. The duel stretched on, an eighth, a quarter, a half. The fractions clipped off. Wolf was going to be good to his word. The track record was coming down. Countless times on that long Santa Anita backstretch, Seabiscuit's legs reached out over the track, stretching to gather up the ground, pounding down into the dirt, then folding up under his belly. With every stride, some 2,000 pounds of force came down on the bones and soft tissues of each foreleg. Today, and Seabiscuit, still moving at record pace, leaned together into the far turn. Seabiscuit switched lead legs so that his left foreleg was bearing the greatest weight. With each stride, he pivoted on the leg, holding the line of the turn at close to 40 miles per hour. Wolf had no idea that beneath him, something was about to go wrong. Halfway around the turn, today began inching away. Seabiscuit was fighting hard but slipping back. Today pushed a full length in front, then shifted down to the rail. Wolf angled Seabiscuit out to go around today and gave him a whack with his whip. Seabiscuit surged forward, coming down heavily onto his left foreleg. Wolf heard a sharp crack. Seabiscuit took an awkward, skipping step. His head pitched downward. Wolf threw his weight back, snatched up the reins, and held Seabiscuit's head up as the horse swung his legs forward and caught himself. The horse pulled himself together and resumed running. Wolf held still for several strides, feeling for lameness, but detected nothing. Perhaps, had Pollard been on him, he would have felt the slight catch in the rhythm, like a playing card clicking against the spokes of a bicycle wheel. But Seabiscuit's stride was hard to read. Wolf felt nothing wrong. He thought Seabiscuit had simply stumbled over a rough part of the track. Wolf backed off. He would catch today in the stretch. He banked into the home stretch, swung out to go around today, and made the biggest mistake of his career. He reached back and struck Seabiscuit across the hip with the whip. Seabiscuit accelerated, and something gave under him. Wolf could feel it now, the jar in the stride. Pain. He stood in the irons and began pulling the horse up. Seabiscuit crossed under the wire, finishing second by slightly more than two lengths. Today had set a record. Seabiscuit reeled down the track. Wolf wanted to get his weight off of his mount's back, but he was going too fast. If he jumped off now, Seabiscuit, obedient to equine instinct to flee pain, would probably tear over the track, exacerbating his injury. Wolf had to control the horse's deceleration. He leaned against the reins. By the time he reached the turn, he had slowed the horse enough to bail out. Wolf kicked off his stirrups, leaned his weight on his hands, swung his right leg over Seabiscuit's rump, and pushed himself into the air. He hit the ground running and hauled the reins back, dragging the horse to a halt. He looked down at the leg. There was no blood, and the limb appeared structurally normal. Wolf led Seabiscuit forward a few steps. The horse's head nodded, his left foreleg hovering in the air. An outrider, a mounted attendant assigned to catch loose horses and assist injured ones, galloped up and grabbed Seabiscuit's bridle. Slowly, gently, the outrider led Seabiscuit back toward the stands. Wolf walked back alone. Up in the clubhouse, Smith and Howard were running. Smith was ahead, slamming into people and shoving them out of the way. Howard followed him. They crossed onto the track and sprinted toward Seabiscuit. The outrider drew Seabiscuit up before Smith. Seabiscuit held a leg up. Smith bent over it. Wolf stood and stared at his mount. His lips were white. Howard rushed up, looked at Seabiscuit, and then wheeled on Wolf. He was near panic. "Why did you do it?" he shouted. "George, why did you do it?" Wolf said something about having believed that the horse had simply stumbled. He said he had had no idea that the horse was injured. He watched them tend to Seabiscuit, then walked back to the jockey's room and sat down, heartsick. He called trainer Whitey Whitehill in, asked permission to be taken off his last mount. A horse ambulance sped up. Smith straightened and waved it away. He needed to see Seabiscuit's gait. Howard held the reins while a groom threw a blanket over his back. They started walking the horse toward the barns. His head nodded with every step. Howard fell in beside him. Smith dropped far behind, frowning and dipping his head to study his horse's stride. He could see that it was the ankle that had gone wrong. The grim procession filed past the grandstand. The shocked fans watched him go. At the Howard barn, there was shouting and running. Grooms dashed everywhere, rushing for ice, Epsom salts, and liniment. Seabiscuit was let up and halted. A groom dipped bandages in ice water laced with Epsom salts and wound them around the left foreleg. The Howards stood and watched, their faces fallen. Behind them, horsemen gathered in silent attendance. A groom walked Seabiscuit around and around the barn. The horse had run a mile at nearly a world record clip, and, injured or not, had to be cooled out. Seabiscuit's head continued to nod. Periodically, the groom stopped him and poured ice water inside his leg bandage while the horse slurped water from a bucket standing on a bench. Howard walked up and looked the leg over. "He never deserved such hard luck," he said. Marcella stood nearby. "The handicap doesn't matter," she said. "He's got to be all right."
"Remember," Smith told Howard, "he went lame at Belmont."
"Yes," Howard responded. "But I never saw him pull up that way. Never before."
Smith had no response. A mournful hush fell over the barn, broken only by the long, low moans of a saddle pony who missed his absent stable companion. All evening long, the deep, sad sound drifted out from the shed rows. When Seabiscuit had cooled out, Smith went over the leg. There was no disturbed hair, no broken skin. They led him back into his stall. He had stopped limping. A veterinarian went in the stall with him, and a ring of stable hands watched from the door while he worked. The veterinarian examined the leg, then painted it in liniment, packed it in mud, and wrapped it loosely in fresh bandages soaked in ice water. He emerged to the forlorn collection of grooms, but offered no verdict. He said the injury needed time to declare itself. It could be as bad as a broken bone or a blown suspensory ligament, or it could be as minor as a kick bruise. Whatever it was, the vet thought Smith was wrong. It was in the knee, he said, not the ankle. Howard and Smith spent the night on their knees in Seabiscuit's stall, taking turns pouring ice water onto the horse's leg. Sometime in the night, Seabiscuit folded up and sank down beside them. He drifted off to sleep. His legs stretched straight out. They kept working while he slept. When Seabiscuit's eyes opened in the morning, Howard and Smith were still there. The horse raised his head and rolled his weight onto his chest, preparing to stand. Howard and Smith held their breath. Seabiscuit pulled his haunches up under him, straightened his forelegs, and pushed. In a moment, Seabiscuit was up. He stood normally on the bad leg and dove into his feed bucket. Then he lowered his head to snatch hay off the floor of his stall. It was his habit to lean onto his left leg when he did so, letting his right knee bend so he could get his mouth to the floor. They watched as he dropped his nose. His right knee bent, just as it always had, and he leaned to the left, onto the bad leg. Howard and Smith exhaled. They led him out into the shed row and eased him into the walking ring. A crowd gathered to see him walk. Looping in big circles, the horse didn't take a lame step. Then Smith asked him to turn sharply left, a trick he had learned to test the suspensory ligaments. The horse bobbled. Smith was right. It was the ankle, not the knee. The veterinarian took radiographs, which would take a while to develop. All they could do now was wait. The Howards spent their time sorting through myriad sympathy notes from fans, some of whom enclosed bottles of remedies for the horse. The X-rays came back. There was no fracture. The injury was in the suspensory ligament. Maybe it was ruptured, maybe it was only bruised. The veterinarian said that if it was ruptured, the horse's career was over. Time would tell. Days passed, and Seabiscuit improved dramatically. Smith walked him every day and studied his gait. The horse had no trace of lameness at the walk, not even when Smith turned him sharply. After 3 days, there was no sign that he had been hurt at all. A few days later, Smith took him out for a long, slow, riderless trip around the track, leading him from Pumpkins back. Several hundred spectators came to see it. Howard stood by the rail and watched through binoculars. Again, the horse seemed perfectly sound and cooled out well. Smith began inching him back into work, giving him easy gallops. It appeared that he had only stung the leg, not incurred a deeper injury. Seabiscuit, they declared, was going to make the 100 grander. Meanwhile, the stable got a little insurance. Kayak won the San Carlos handicap, nailing Specify at the wire and breaking the track record. And a curious dispatch came in from the San Francisco World's Fair. Fair promoters wanted Seabiscuit to be an exhibit. They offered to build a special paddock and walking ring and give Howard a handsome cut of the 50-cent viewing fee they would charge spectators.
Howard declined, citing a most unlikely reason. We do not care to commercialize Seabiscuit. On February 23rd, Smith took Seabiscuit back to the track to continue his preparation. The horse sped over the track, level and even. Then there was a bobble. The rider abruptly stood up and threw his weight against the reins. The head nodded again. Smith and Howard didn't need to say much to each other. They both knew. Seabiscuit's suspensory ligament was ruptured. Howard, his shoulders sagging with disappointment, stood at the clubhouse rail and told reporters that they weren't going to make it. Smith pulled himself together and went on. He moved the special safety door from Seabiscuit's stall to kayaks. Howard brought a man to the barn to make plaster casts of Seabiscuit's hooves for the production of souvenir ashtrays. The horse stood there calmly for an hour and a half as the man fooled with his feet. Howard stood by and watched. Neither he nor Marcella could muster any enthusiasm for the 100 grander. A week later, it was Kayak, not Seabiscuit, whom Smith escorted to the track for the Santa Anita Handicap. Reporters queried him on his chances without Seabiscuit. "Watch my smoke," he said. On the way out, he stopped briefly before Seabiscuit's stall. Outside, a grandstand swollen with spectators awaited him. Several million people were tuned in to the radio broadcast. Buenos Aires was at a standstill. Kayak was Argentine. In the midst of the crowd at Santa Anita sat Charles and Marcella Howard. Forced smiles papered over their faces. A few minutes later, Kayak cannonballed down the home stretch to win the 1939 Santa Anita Handicap. Marcella and Charles broke into tears. Someone asked Charles for a comment. "Oh, gosh, it was grand," he said, his voice catching in his throat. He turned his back and hid his face among his closest friends, who ringed around him. "Kayak the Second is a good horse," he whispered. "But gee, it wasn't Seabiscuit." After the ceremonies, the Howards hurried from the track. That night they attended the Turf Club ball. As always, Howard tried to get Smith to come, but the trainer never showed up. Santa Anita officials presented Howard with the traditional Golden Winner's Trophy, then gave him a cup commemorating Seabiscuit. "I am extremely proud of the horse," Howard said of Kayak, "but I can't help saying I would have been happier had Seabiscuit been the winner." The Howards returned home. Marcella felt hollow. Chapter 21. A Long, Hard Pull. Agnes Conlon joined Red Pollard's strange world on April 10, 1939. Back in Willits, Doc Babcock had finally set Pollard's leg properly, and it was beginning to heal. He limped out of the hospital in early spring. Babcock sent him out with a stern warning. His leg would not stand the rigors of riding. If he went back to racing, he could be crippled for the rest of his life. He must never mount a horse again. Pollard smiled. "Then I reckon I'll have to find somebody to boost me up," he said. Pollard took up residence at Ridgewood and immediately called for Agnes to come marry him. With no money to spare, they planned for a quiet, private weekday wedding and a modest honeymoon, and then Pollard would begin his long journey back to the saddle. Red wanted to be sure that she got the wedding gift she wanted most, a diamond watch. So he mailed her what little money he had so she could pick it out herself. Instead of buying the watch, Agnes bought an extra ticket west so her mother could see her marry. She had wanted to wear her sister's elaborate wedding dress, but their pennilessness called for something less formal. She packed up a simple navy pinstripe suit, hat and sandals, and embarked on her journey to California. She was in for a surprise. Pollard greeted her with a beautiful wedding, undoubtedly financed and planned by Marcella. The ranch was decorated for the occasion, and legions of Pollard's friends, including Yummy, Speck Richardson, Doc Babcock, and a host of hospital staffers, were in attendance. Pollard, still underweight, was bundled into a double-breasted black suit. The left pant leg slit over his cast. Agnes was stunned by the preparations and a little mortified that all she had brought was the navy suit. Under the sunlight in Willits, Agnes and Red Pollard spent their first married moments standing together, hearing the good wishes of their friends. Agnes smiled demurely, pressing the tips of her fingers into Red's palm and averting her eyes from the Associated Press photographer who was covering the wedding. Red stood by her, his bad leg angled out. It was a melancholy season at Ridgewood. Smith, preparing to take his kayak east, vanned Seabiscuit to Ridgewood, said his goodbyes, and left him in Pollard's care. The horse was led into his new home, a handsome stall adjoining his own private paddock. He was not ready for retirement. He was bred to 7 mares, including Phaeronitis, but it didn't do much for his mood. Restive, he stalked the fences on his lame leg. Howard's spirits mirrored those of his horse. In Seabiscuit's racetrack days, Howard had made a habit of coming to the track every morning. Now he stopped going altogether. He and Marcella spent much of their time at the stallion barn, petting Seabiscuit. At times, Howard lingered there for several hours. The papers referred to Seabiscuit as retired, but Howard wouldn't use that word. He was hanging on to the idea that somehow the horse might race again. Red and Agnes returned from a honeymoon on Catalina Island, and the broken-legged jockey began the period of his life that he would call a long, hard pull. Red would go up to the barn, hitch a lead rope onto Seabiscuit, and head off into the meadows, swinging painfully along on his crutches while Seabiscuit limped beside him. "We were a couple of old cripples together," Red said, "all washed up. But somehow we both had a pretty good idea that we'd be back." Howard's friends stood on the hills and watched them go, shaking their heads at the sad sight of two athletes whose bodies had failed them. Sonny Greenberg came out to look the horse's leg over. "There is no way," he thought, "that they'll get this one back on the track." At first Pollard was too weak to go far, but he gradually built up his endurance. Hour after hour, day after day, Pollard and Pops walked together. When Pollard tired, he would lead Seabiscuit back and leave him off in the hands of his new groom, Harry Bradshaw. Bradshaw was a backstretch legend, a man with such magical skills at tending lameness that once, when a man was negotiating to buy an elite horse in Bradshaw's care, he refused to take the horse unless Bradshaw was part of the bargain. Smith had made a special effort to get him out to the farm, and had given him detailed instructions on how to care for the horse. Bradshaw took his job seriously, staying at the barn day and night to nurse Seabiscuit's ankle. Agnes and Red began their marriage. Red taught her to drive a car along the roads lined with redwoods. He took her out to the barns, helped her up on the backs of the horses, and watched her ride. For Agnes, every moment was stolen time. Red was so frail that she feared his life was still in danger. She discovered that he was already deep into alcoholism. And she learned how he tortured his body to make weight. Horse racing had made him a cripple and an addict, and now he was going back to it. Slowly, painfully, horse and rider healed. Pollard was soon off his crutches and took to leaning on a cane. He wore weighted shoes to strengthen his wasted leg muscles. The bones of his leg were so weak that he needed to wear a fur-lined metal brace to prevent them from buckling. But they held up. Seabiscuit's lameness at the walk disappeared. Howard began slipping out to the barn in the morning with Pollard, and one day, when the urge was too strong, they got out a stock saddle and cinched it on Seabiscuit. Howard gently lifted Pollard into the saddle. The redhead was far too weak to hold the horse, so Howard swung aboard a pinto horse named Tick-Tock, took Seabiscuit's lead rope, and led the two around the meadows, gradually increasing the length and speed of each outing. Soon, Howard had a little track of 3/8 of a mile cut out of the flat valley land. He began leading Seabiscuit and Red onto it for long, slow walks. Seabiscuit was starting to feel fine. Within hours of his birth, He had known how to run, and speed had been the measure of his life ever since. He knew what the track was for, and it wasn't walking. He was frantic to run. His whole body gathered up behind the bit, and he skittered around like a downed electrical wire, begging Pollard to turn him loose. Howard had left a bushy gully in the center of his makeshift track, and one morning the sight of the horses and men spooked the deer hiding out inside. They bolted for the hills, streaking past Seabiscuit.
"Good Lord," Howard remembered later. "The first time he spotted one, he thought the race was on."
Seabiscuit yanked the reins loose and bounded off after the deer, imitating the animal's pogo stick strides. Pollard somehow hung on. Howard kept his grip on the lead rope, and they pulled Seabiscuit to a halt. A few hundred miles south, Tom Smith sat in the sun by the barns at Hollywood Park. His eyes were trained on Kayak, who hung his head out of his half-door, surveying the backstretch. Smith was in the midst of a trying season. First, Seabiscuit was injured. Then Kayak was hurt in a freak accident when something blew across the track and caused him to bolt. He came down wrong, gashed himself badly, and wound up out of training. After a period of convalescence, the horse returned to racing, only to be injured again. All Smith had to cling to was a wild thought that Seabiscuit might someday return. Smith's eyes played over Kayak. A reporter walked up. "Wouldn't it be great," the newsman said, "if the Biscuit could stage a comeback?" Smith slid up in his chair. "I suppose," he said, an edge to his voice, "you think he won't come back?" The reporter, flustered, stammered out something about the rarity of successful comebacks. Smith stood up. "The Biscuit will come back," he said in a voice more emotional than he meant it to be. "He'll come back and fool the whole turf world." Smith seemed uncomfortable. He drew himself together and smiled at the reporter. Kayak continued to gaze out the door. Pollard had learned a thing or two about training from Smith, and he managed Seabiscuit's rehabilitation carefully. By early summer, walking turned to a gentle canter. First a mile, then two, then three. Seabiscuit kept pulling, but Pollard never gave in. The turns on the little track were too tight, the leg too delicate. Howard walked out to the barn every morning with a quiver in his gut, afraid that they might make a mistake and re-injure Seabiscuit. But the horse kept getting stronger and sounder. An idea was working around in the heads of everyone at Ridgewood. Howard and Smith might be right. Seabiscuit might make it back to the races. Outside the ranch, it was considered an absurd idea. Inside, it seemed somehow possible. Everyone went to work. Bradshaw began strapping Seabiscuit into a fur-lined muzzle to get the extra pounds off him, and they weighed the horse every week. When a groom was caught sneaking carrots to Seabiscuit, Pollard ran him off with a pitchfork, and the groom was summarily fired. Seabiscuit took to stomping and bellowing for food day and night. His moans rang off the barn walls and worked on everyone's nerves, but no one gave in. "The whole ranch became centered on the job," Howard said. "Even the pigs quit grunting at him, and the chickens kept out of his way." By summer's end, Seabiscuit had made surprising progress. He was now soundly negotiating 5 miles a day. Beneath Pollard, there was something different. Seabiscuit was developing a new stride. No longer did he stab out with the foreleg as he ran, producing the curiously choppy duck-waddle gait that so many observers had mistaken for lameness. He now folded his legs up neatly under him when airborne, directing all of his motion forward and back, not side to side. It was a beautiful, smooth gait, and probably a sounder one. Seabiscuit was in fighting trim and hard as rock, and Pollard, though still a wreck, was at least strong enough to handle him. "Our wheels went wrong together, but we were good for each other," he said. "Out there among the hooting owls, we both got sound again." On her trips to the barn, Marcella also noticed something new. Seabiscuit was pacing around his stall, as he had done in his days with Fitzsimmons. When he paused, he directed his gaze at the horizon, distracted. Howard saw that look and knew what it meant. "You knew he wanted to race again," he said, "more than anything else in the world." In the fall, Howard called Smith in. The trainer motored up to the ranch and silently watched as Seabiscuit, looking blocky in his winter coat, was galloped in front of him. Smith scrutinized the horse from head to toe. He was deeply impressed with the work Pollard had done with him. They were all thinking the same thing. Seabiscuit was ready to take another run at the Santa Anita Handicap. The idea was outlandish. The comeback, if successful, would be unprecedented. No elite horse had ever returned to top form after such a serious injury and lengthy layoff. Few great horses have competed beyond age 5 or through more than 40 races. In a couple of months, Seabiscuit would be a bewhiskered 7 years old, more than twice the age of many of the horses he would be facing, and he had already raced 85 times. When word got out, the Howard team would be widely ridiculed. But Smith, Howard, and Pollard believed he could do it. Pollard wanted to go with him. He had never lost his belief that he could ride in races again, though no one who looked at him as he leaned on his cane, his leg grotesquely thin and discolored, his body weak and emaciated, would have agreed with him. His desire became urgency. Agnes began experiencing unusual symptoms and paid a visit to her doctor. He told her that she was pregnant. She thought he had to be wrong. She was certain that Red was too weak to be capable of fathering a child. But the doctor's verdict was unequivocal. Agnes was going to have a baby. For Pollard, the news was at once wonderful and terrifying. He was still living on the Howards' good graces. He had no money, no home, no career. He had only Seabiscuit. He told Howard he wanted to go back to the track with the horse. Howard was frightened for him. Doc Babcock had said that Pollard was never to go near a horse again. One bump, one twist, and he could lose his ability to walk forever. All Howard would agree to was to let him come along. On a cool day in the late fall of 1939, Pollard and Seabiscuit set out for Santa Anita to chase the one dream that had eluded them.
Chapter 22. Four Good Legs Between Us. Charles Howard knew something about making an entrance. In the pre-dawn hours of one December morning in 1939, the Seabiscuit crew came whooping and hollering into Santa Anita in a manner only a man as spectacular as Howard could have pulled off. Their vehicle was a streamlined palace horse van painted in Howard crimson and white and featuring 2 musical horns, 8 headlights, 14 cigar lighters, and a luxurious stall with kapok stuffed walls. The back doors dropped open, and Smith and Seabiscuit emerged. Smith took the horse straight down the shed rows, pulled him up at the Kaiser suite, and evicted Kayak. "Have to give the better horse preference," he grunted. The first fans arrived at daybreak. All morning long, hundreds of them streamed into Barn 38 to greet the old warrior. Among them was Wolf. Seabiscuit came to the door and rubbed his face against the jockey's fedora. Smith, knowing that returning the horse to racing was controversial, took the offensive with the press. With a host of newsmen congregated outside, he led Seabiscuit out and stood him in an open space between the barns. He announced that anyone who was suspicious of the horse's soundness could step right up and have a look. He asked the photographers to take close-up shots of the horse's left ankle. "If anybody thinks I am training a cripple," he said, "I want these pictures definitely to prove otherwise." The 1940 100 grander was on March 2nd, giving Smith about 3 months to prepare the horse. He got to work. He had Seabiscuit's heavy winter coat clipped off and took him to the scales. The horse weighed in at 1,070, 20 pounds too much.
Smith was worried that the load would strain the leg, so he pulled out the yellow sweating hood and gave the horse slow gallops. In the barn, they strapped the horse into a muzzle each evening to stop him from eating his bedding. Seabiscuit put up a fight, but the groom managed to get it on without losing any fingers. Gradually, the weight vanished from the horse's ribs. On December 19th, Smith felt the horse was ready to be tested. He tacked him up and took him out for his first fast workout since the injury. As the grooms watched and fretted, Smith waved the exercise rider on. Venting months of frustration, Seabiscuit burned rubber off the line and sped past the grandstand. He came back perfectly sound. The grooms sagged with relief. The mood didn't last long. Late that afternoon, Smith went into the track secretary's office to see the weight postings for the Santa Anita handicap. He couldn't believe his eyes. Though he had been idle for a year, Seabiscuit had been assigned 130 pounds, Kayak, 129 pounds. As he ran his eyes down the list, the highest number Smith saw for any other horse was 114. Smith lit up like a firecracker. He stormed around the office and shouted about the irresponsibility of the handicapper. A gathering of horsemen gaped at him. Silent Tom's tirade lasted a full 5 minutes. After giving vent to his anger, he pulled himself together and stalked off. "So what?" he grumbled. "We'll run 1-2 anyway." The year 1940 rolled in with heavy black clouds. Snow brushed over the tips of every peak up in the San Gabriels, but down on the track, there was only rain and slippery mud. Smith tucked Seabiscuit away in the barn and waited for a break in the weather. It didn't come. Day after day, the rains kept falling. Over and over again, Smith postponed Seabiscuit's workouts. He spent every minute with the horse, sleeping in the barn, watching him eat, personally wrapping his legs in tall bandages, but he wouldn't let him out to work. Pressure began to build. Seabiscuit was entered in several races, and each time he had to be scratched. The crowds booed and the press picked at Smith and Howard. "If Seabiscuit is scratched again," wrote a reporter, "he will be an etching." The whole barn was in a funk. Kayak was trounced in his first race of 1940. Not a single Howard runner won. Seabiscuit may have been trapped in the barn, but his idleness didn't hurt his celebrity. He was the hottest name in the nation. Fans thronged into the Uptown Theater in Pasadena to see The Life of Seabiscuit, a compilation of the horse's newsreel footage. The film relegated a much-anticipated Jimmy Stewart movie to second billing. The stylish Seabiscuit lady's hat with a fishnet veil was all the rage in department stores on Manhattan's Fifth Avenue. The hat was the first of myriad lines of signature products, toys, commemorative wastebaskets, two varieties of oranges. All kinds of businesses, from hotels to laundries to humor magazines, were using the horse's likeness in their ads. The horse even had his own parlor game, the first of at least nine. When Pollard hung up his tack in the Santa Anita jockey's room, he found the riding colony in an uproar. Just before the track season had begun in December, Pollard's old colleague, Tommy Luther, had sat down for coffee in the Santa Anita Golf Club with a handful of other riders. They began chatting about the alarming number of jockeys who had been wiped out by injuries, including Pollard. Luther had never gotten over the death of poor little Sandy Graham, thrown from a horse Luther was to have ridden. He had an idea. Why not ask each rider to contribute 10 cents for every ride, plus $20 a year, to a community fund that could help injured riders? The five riders liked the idea and agreed to have a second meeting at the golf club, each man bringing two riders with him. The next morning, when Luther arrived to pick up his jockey's license for the track's winter meet, he was called before Old Pink Whiskers, steward Christopher Fitzgerald, who asked about the meetings. Luther explained his fund idea. Pink Whiskers accused him of starting a union. Luther denied it. Pink Whiskers promptly banned him from riding for a full year for his defiant and threatening attitude. The ban was upheld everywhere in the country. Luther refused to back down. He rallied the jockeys around him, and each week the riders streamed across the street to the golf club. Wolf was there, as were Speck Richardson and Harry Richards. But Pollard refused to go. No man in the riding colony needed a community fund more. He had twice narrowly escaped dying in riding accidents that had landed him in the hospital for months on end, wiped him out financially, and caused near-crippling injury. Now he was forcing himself back into the saddle at the risk of his leg because he hadn't a cent to his name to support a coming baby. Red Pollard should have been the community fund's poster boy, but all he could think of was Charles and Marcella Howard. With the jockeys' efforts widely perceived as the formation of a union against stewards, owners, and trainers, Pollard feared that he might offend the Howards by crossing the street and walking into the golf club. To the exasperation of his fellow riders, Pollard stayed away. For Pollard, it was a season of incredible strain and humiliation. Before arriving at Santa Anita, he had tried to resume his career at Tanforan. At first, he found a few trainers who wanted to help him get back on his feet. The result was nearly catastrophic. He had come away hopping from two horses in obvious pain. He had looked very weak, and everyone, including the newsmen, had noticed, and he hadn't won a race. He came down to Santa Anita resolving to do better. Yummy, still as fiercely loyal as he had been back in their Thistledown days, joined up with him again and promised to get him mounts. Red and Agnes settled into a little rental house near the track. Pollard built his strength, hit the sack early, and rose well before dawn to head back to the track. But his declarations of readiness were received with awkward silence. Everyone knew what had happened at Tanforan. Yummy scoured the backstretch for trainers willing to put the cougar on their horses. He didn't find one. Every trainer on the grounds believed Pollard was finished, and no one wanted to be responsible for crippling him. The biggest disappointment was Howard. Even when he had been at the top of his game with Seabiscuit, Pollard had never established himself with any other major stable, so Howard was his only real hope. Smith wanted Pollard on the horse for the 100-grander. Howard wanted to grant the redhead his wish, but both he and Marcella were tormented by the thought of what it would cost him. He let Pollard ride Seabiscuit in slow gallops, but it kept him off the horse's back for most of his fast workouts. At first, Howard would not allow Pollard to ride in races on any of his horses. Then, one afternoon in late January, he finally relented and assigned the jockey the race mount on a filly. But when the track came up muddy, Howard abruptly snatched Pollard off the horse and put someone else in his place, fearing that the filly might slip and jar the jockey's leg. From then on, when jockeys' names were posted for Howard's horses, Pollard was never among them. In a sport in which men are measured by their toughness, he must have felt humiliated. Pollard was left with nothing to do. His anguish deepened. He sat in Pop's stall, thinking about Agnes's pregnancy and wondering how he would find the money to support the baby. He told Howard again and again that he was fit to ride in the 100-grander, but got nowhere. The truth was that Pollard couldn't even convince himself. The leg didn't feel right in his boot. The bones felt like matchsticks. He was sure that it wouldn't take more than a light bump to shatter them. A secret terror began to rack his mind. What if Howard let him ride, and his leg snapped in mid-race? And then there was Wolf. Seeing that Howard might bar Pollard from riding, Smith had started letting Wolf gallop Seabiscuit. There was widespread speculation that either Wolf or Buddy Haas, Kayak's jockey, would be signed on to ride Seabiscuit in the big race. Almost everyone at Santa Anita thought that anyone but Pollard should ride. Pollard called his naysayers my left-handed rooting section. Pollard watched Wolf canter off on Pops. Despair rushed up under him like a riptide. "And none so poor," he muttered to a reporter, echoing Julius Caesar, "to do me reverence." Pollard began to crumble under the pressure. He had become a binge drinker. He made a point of temperance during working hours. "Never let it be said," he once told his friend Bill Buck, that Pollard was drinking when he was riding. But during off hours, he sometimes drank heavily.
"Tonight's the night,"
he once shouted as he ran into Buck's apartment near the end of a race season.
"The cougar howls!"
When he drank, he endured monstrous hangovers and appeared to suffer from delirium tremens.
"I got to wear glued shoes when I'm hung," he said, "because I shake the nails out of the other kind."
Yummy was frightened for him. If Pollard began drinking too heavily, he would lose any chance he had to ride Seabiscuit. Yummy did everything he could to keep the jockey from going on benders. He asked Pollard to come stay with him at the Turkish Baths. Pollard refused. So Yummy shadowed him everywhere. He made a point of knowing exactly where his client was 24 hours a day. He asked David Alexander to stay around Pollard as much as possible to keep him from over-imbibing. In an apparent bargain to keep him dry until the race, Yummy made a deal with the rider. If Pollard won the 100-grander, Yummy promised to sneak him a swig of Bow Wow wine in the winner's circle. Pollard wasn't the only one feeling the strain. Smith was racked with anxiety. His whole life, recalled Sonny Greenberg, was gathered around Seabiscuit. Howard, too, was at the breaking point. Over a 5-year partnership, these two radically different men with often conflicting priorities had forged a surprisingly harmonious relationship. But decisions about Seabiscuit's racing and training schedule had repeatedly caused tension between them. When under pressure, each man had a tendency to become more controlling, and never was the pressure higher than in the winter of 1940. One morning at Santa Anita, Howard pushed Smith hard to take a course with Seabiscuit that Smith was not prepared to take, apparently to rush his very conservative training regimen. In front of a barn full of horsemen, Smith laid down the law. "Let me train my horse as I see fit," he snapped, "or find a new trainer." Everyone within earshot froze, listening for Howard's response. Howard said nothing and walked away. January waned, and still Seabiscuit had not raced. Witchsea, Heelfly, all his rivals were preparing well. The rains didn't relent. Smith couldn't wait any longer. He took Seabiscuit and Kayak out for a hard workout on the training track. For once, Pollard was allowed to ride Seabiscuit for speed. In a driving rainstorm that sent everyone running, Seabiscuit and Kayak blistered 6 furlongs in 1:13, with Pollard leaning all the way back against the reins, his feet on the dashboard. Horse and jockey returned intact. A few days later, Smith sent Seabiscuit back out again, and again his time was superb, 1:12.25 for 6 furlongs. Pollard said the horse had never been sounder. After the workout, Smith entered Seabiscuit in the San Felipe Handicap, scheduled for January 30th. Pollard awaited a decision on whether or not he would be in the irons. Smith announced that Pollard would ride. But Howard added an escape clause. Pollard would ride only if he was fit to do so. If he wasn't, Howard said, Wolf had them out. He said nothing about the 100-grander, now just a month away. Wolf and Pollard fell into the first crisis of their friendship. To Pollard, the mount on Seabiscuit could not have been more important. The horse meant financial rescue, the ability to meet his responsibilities as father and husband, professional redemption, and the end of a long public humiliation. But Wolf must have burned with the frustration of the nose loss in 1938 and the guilt for having possibly exacerbated the horse's injury in 1939. In announcing publicly that it was Wolf or Pollard, Howard had inadvertently set the two against each other. Somewhere along the backstretch, Wolf and Pollard had a bitter argument over Seabiscuit, nearly coming to blows. When they walked away, their friendship was broken. January 29th dawned sunny and clear. Howard started the long walk to the track offices to enter his horse in the next day's San Felipe. As he ambled around the course, the barometer in the track secretary's office leaned toward rain. He entered the horse. Seeing that Seabiscuit was in,
NBC Radio began setting up at Santa Anita to broadcast the race nationally. The barometer continued to sink.